I decide motion in order to swim. But fish don't have to worry much about gravity and shock absorption, since they are suspended in water. Mammals, however, must use limbs to hold their body weight, and those limbs must attach to the spinal column. Different mammals have different postures, and so require different strategies for weight distribution via the spine. In almost all of the tremendously diverse spinal columns found in nature, the spinal discs have adapted to the posture and gait of the animal. But not in ours. In humans, the vertebral discs are in an arrangement that is optimal for knuckle draggers, not upright walkers. They still do a decent job of lubricating and supporting the spine, but they are much more prone to being pushed out of position than the vertebral discs of other animals. They are structured to resist gravity by pulling the vertebral joints toward the chest, as if humans were on all fours. With our upright posture, however, gravity often pulls them backward or downward, not toward the chest. Over time, this uneven pressure creates protuberances in the cartilage. This is known as a spinal disc herniation, or, more commonly, a slipped disc. Spinal disc herniation is nearly unheard of in any primate species but us. Our ancestors began walking upright about 6 million years ago. It was one of the first physical changes as they diverged from other apes. It's disappointing, although not altogether surprising, that human anatomy has not had time to catch up and complete this adaptation. However, at least we use all the bones that we have in our backs. As mentioned earlier, as humans evolved to stand upright, a couple of bones were added to the lower back. Apparently, evolution can duplicate bones when needed. It seems it's not as good at deleting them when they're no longer needed. No bones about it. Humans have way too many bones. This flaw isn't unique to us. Nature is replete with animals that have bones they don't need, joints that don't flex, structures that aren't attached to anything, and appendages that cause more problems than they're worth. The reason for this is that embryonic development is extremely complicated. For a body to take shape, thousands of genes must be activated and deactivated in a precise order, perfectly coordinated in time and space. When a bone, for example, is no longer needed, deleting it is not as easy as flipping a switch. Hundreds, maybe thousands, of switches must be flipped, and they must be flipped in such a way as to not screw up the thousands of other structures that are also built with those same genes. Remember, too, that natural selection flips these switches randomly, like a chimpanzee at a typewriter. If we wait long enough, the chimp will write a sonnet, but the wait will be long indeed. For anatomy, the result is a whole lot of baggage lying around. For humans, some of the most striking anatomical redundancies are found in our skeletons. Take the wrist. It's a capable joint, no doubt about it. It can twist nearly 180 degrees in all rotational planes, despite the vessels, nerves, and other cords that run from the arm to precise places in the hand. However, it is way more complicated than it needs to be. There are 8 different bones in the wrist, not including the 2 bones of the forearm and the 5 bones of the hand. The small area that is just the wrist itself has 8 fully formed and distinct bones tucked in there like a pile of rocks, which is about how useful they are to anyone. Collectively, these wrist bones are helpful, but they don't really do anything individually. They sort of sit there when you move your hand. Yes, they connect the arm bones to the hand bones through a complex system of ligaments and tendons, but this arrangement is incredibly complicated and redundant. Redundancy can be a desirable thing, as we saw with our poor Achilles tendon, but not in the case of bones. Having extra bones requires many more attachment points for tendons, ligaments, and muscles. Each one of those points of contact is a weakness, a potential for strain, or, as happens with the ACL, a debilitating tear. We have examples of superbly designed joints in our bodies. The shoulder and hip joints come to mind. Not the wrist, though. No sane engineer would design a joint with so many individual moving parts. It clutters up the space and restricts the range of motion. If the wrist were rationally designed, it would allow the hand a full range of motion so that the fingers could bend backward and lie along the top of the arm. But of course, it can't do that. The flexibility of the wrist joint is restricted by the many bones in there, not facilitated by them. The human ankle suffers from the same clutter of bones that we find in the wrist. The ankle contains 7 bones, most of them pointless. The ankle certainly has more to deal with than the wrist does, given that it is constantly bearing weight and is central to the locomotion of the entire body. But this is all the more reason why we would be better served by a simpler joint, because many of the bones of the ankle do not move relative to one another. They would function better as a single, fused structure. Their ligaments were placed with solid bone. Thus simplified, the ankle would be much stronger, and many of their current points of potential strain would be eliminated. There is a reason that twisted and sprained ankles are so common. The skeletal design of the ankle is a hodgepodge of parts that can do nothing except malfunction. While the wrist bones and ankle bones are the most obnoxious examples of bones for which we have no use, there are others. For example, the tailbone. The coccyx is the terminal part of the spinal column and consists of the last 3, or 4 or 5, depending on which you count, vertebrae fused together in a C-shaped structure. This section of bone has no function in humans. It doesn't house or protect anything. The spinal cord, which vertebrae are designed to protect, terminates much higher than where the coccyx begins. It is vestigial, a remnant from our ancestors who had tails. Nearly all vertebrates have tails, including most primates. The great apes are among the rare exceptions, but even apes begin their embryonic lives with prominent tails. That tail eventually shrinks, and by the 21st or 22nd gestational week, its vestige has become the worthless coccyx. Attached to the coccyx, there is even the tiny remnant of a muscle, the dorsal sacrococcygeal muscle, that could flex the tailbone if the bones weren't fused. A pointless muscle for this pointless cluster of bones. The coccyx does retain some connections to nearby musculature. It also bears much weight while you're in a reclined or seated position. But for the rare people whose tailbones are surgically removed because of injury or cancer, there are no long-term complications. The human skull, like that of other vertebrates, is also a strange mishmash of bones that fuse together during childhood to form a single structure. The average human skull has 22 bones. Some people have more, with a lot of duplication. That is, the skull often has right side and left side versions of bones, a right and left jawbone fused together in the middle, for example, and a right and left top palate. There's no clear reason for this redundancy. While it makes sense that arms are separate structures, the same can't be said of the bones underneath the upper lip area. As with the duplicated bones in our skulls, there is no real reason to have paired bones in our forearms and lower legs. The upper arm has 1 bone, but the lower arm has 2. Same for the leg. The thigh has 1 bone, but the shin has 2. Yes, the 2 bones in the lower arm do allow for a twisting motion, but that's not the case in the lower leg. You cannot twist your leg below the knee without breaking something. Even in the forearm, having 2 parallel bones is not the only way to make a joint that can twist. In fact, having 2 bones ensures that the twisting cannot possibly exceed 180 degrees, since the bones unavoidably knock into each other when you twist them. For comparison, the shoulders and hips do the task of twisting even better than the elbow, and they do it without the 2-bone arrangement. No robot arm will ever be designed to imitate our nonsensical bone structure. Human anatomy is beautiful, no doubt about it. We are very well adapted to our environment, but we are not perfectly adapted. Little imperfections exist. It's possible that, if our ancestors had lived the hunter-gatherer life for a longer time before moving into the modern era of vaccines and surgery, evolution would have continued to perfect human anatomy. However, that environment, like all environments, was so dynamic that evolution would simply have substituted our current imperfections for others. Evolution is a continual process, never quite complete. Evolution and adaptation are more like running on a treadmill than running on a track. We must keep adapting in order to avoid extinction. But it can feel like we never really get anywhere. Coda, a dolphin with hind fins. Although we humans have our share of superfluous bones, there are many other animals with even more blatant examples of vestigial structures and extra bones. For example, there are some species of snakes that have tiny vestiges of a pelvis, though their limbs were lost eons ago. These useless snake pelvises don't attach to anything and perform no function. Then again, they don't really harm the animal. If they did, natural selection would have completed their removal from the body plan. Most whales also have the internal remnants of a pelvis, the quiet whispers of their legged ancestors that wandered back into the ocean more than 40 million years ago. When these ancestors returned to marine life, their forelimbs gradually evolved into pectoral fins. Their hind limbs, however, simply regressed into nothing. In 2006, Japanese fishermen caught a dolphin that had tiny hind fins, for lack of a better term. This dolphin, later named AO4, was a rare find and was sent to the Taiji Whale Museum for display and further study. The discovery of a dolphin with a tiny but perfectly formed pair of hind fins reveals the power of single mutation during development. In this case, a random mutation just happened to undo a previous mutation. Obviously, these are rare events, rather like lightning hitting the same place twice, but they are powerfully informative when we do find them. As of this writing, there has been no reported discovery of the precise mutation responsible for AO4, but the scientific hunt continues. It appears that the hind fins of dolphins didn't slowly regress in tiny increments down to nothing. Rather, a single mutation was able to take the last dramatic step and cause them to disappear entirely. Similar kinds of high-impact mutations were almost certainly responsible for the duplication of vertebrae in our species' lower back when we needed more of them for upright posture. Don't believe me? Humans are born every day with extra fingers or toes, perfectly formed and functional. If having 12 fingers had conferred a big advantage sometime in our evolutionary past, you can bet that everyone would have 12 fingers now. Genes important for embryonic development have far-reaching effects. And so mutations in just the right spot can make large anatomical rearrangements. These rearrangements are random, and therefore usually result in harmful birth defects. But when we're talking about evolutionary timescales, events that seem unimaginably rare are possible. Mutations like AO4s lift the evolutionary veil that normally conceals an animal's past life. The mutation-driven tweaks and tugs of evolution can sometimes be undone with dramatic results. Because we are constantly reminded of the slow and steady pace of evolution, we don't normally think of it as dramatic. The dolphin AO4 reminds us that, at times, it can be. 2. Our needy diet. Why humans, unlike other animals, require vitamins C and B12 in their diets, why almost half of all children and pregnant women are anemic despite getting plenty of iron, why we are all doomed to calcium deficiency, and more. A casual stroll through a bookstore or library will reveal shelves upon shelves of books about food and eating. There are books on the history of cooking, books on exotic and ancient foods, cookbooks, and of course, advice guides and manuals for fad diets. We are constantly reminded of all the various things we need to eat. You must eat enough vegetables. Don't forget the fruits. A balanced breakfast is important. Remember to get lots of fiber. Meat and nuts are important for protein. Be sure to get omega-3 fatty acids. Dairy is important for calcium. Leafy greens are vital for magnesium and B vitamins. You cannot stay healthy by eating the same thing all the time. You should maintain a diverse diet in order to get all the various nutrients that your body needs. And then there are the supplements. Now, most scientists consider the supplement industry a sham. I'm looking at you, herbal supplements. But many of these pills and powders do contain essential vitamins and minerals, of which we simply must consume a minimum amount in order to be healthy. Some people's diets don't give them everything they need, and even people who get everything they need can't always absorb it properly. So sometimes we need a little boost. That's why we're always being told to drink milk, for instance. It gives us the calcium that we need, but can't produce in sufficient quantities ourselves. Now, compare our demanding diet with the diet of the cows that produce that milk. Cows can survive on pretty much nothing but grass. They live long and perfectly healthy lives and produce delicious milk and rich meat. How can these cows thrive without a delicate mix of legumes, fruits, fiber, meat, and dairy, like humans are told to eat? Forget cows. Look at your own cats or dogs. Consider how simple their diets are. Most dog food is nothing more than meat and rice. No vegetables, no fruits, no supplemental vitamins. Dogs do just fine on this diet and, if not overfed, can live long and healthy lives. How do these animals do it? Simple. They are better designed for eating. Humans have more dietary requirements than almost any other animal in the world. Our bodies fail to make many of the things that other animals do. Since we don't make certain necessary nutrients, we have to consume them in our diet or we die. This chapter tells the story of all the things we need to have in our diets simply because our lackluster bodies can't make them for us. Substances as basic as, say, vitamins. The scurvy of humanity. Vitamins are what is known as essential micronutrients, a category of molecules and ions that we must get from our diets or we will suffer and die. Other essential micronutrients are minerals, fatty acids, and amino acids. Vitamins are among the largest molecules that cells need to survive. Most vitamins assist other molecules to facilitate key chemical reactions inside our bodies. For example, vitamin C assists at least 8 enzymes, including 3 that are necessary for the synthesis of collagen. Even though we have these enzymes, they cannot make collagen without vitamin C. When the enzymes can't work, we get sick. Vitamin C is called essential not because it is important, but because we must get it from our diets. All vitamins are important, crucial even to human health, but those that are essential are the ones that we cannot make ourselves and therefore must ingest. In addition to vitamin C, there are other essential vitamins that perform important functions in the body. The B vitamins, for example, aid in the extraction of energy from food. Vitamin D helps us absorb and use calcium. Vitamin A is crucial for the functioning of the retina, and vitamin E has a wide variety of roles throughout the body, including protecting tissues from free radicals, harmful byproducts of chemical reactions. The one thing that this diverse family of molecules has in common is that our bodies cannot make them. This is what makes vitamins A, B, C, D, and E different than, say, vitamin K or vitamin Q. If you haven't heard of those vitamins, it's because they are not essential in the dietary sense of the word. They are just as important as other vitamins, but we don't need to get them from our food because we make them ourselves. When people can't produce a specific vitamin and can't get it through their food, their health can really, really suffer. Again, vitamin C offers a useful example. School children in the United States often begin their study of American history by learning about the 15th and 16th century Europeans who explored this continent. I distinctly remember a story my classmates and I were told about how sailors carried potatoes or limes on their long voyages in order to prevent scurvy. As we now know, this horrible disease is caused by a deficiency in vitamin C. Without it, we cannot make collagen, an essential component of something called the extracellular matrix, or ECM. The ECM is like a microskeleton that runs through all of our organs and tissues, giving them shape and structure. Without vitamin C, the ECM gets weak. Tissues lose integrity, bones become brittle, we bleed from various orifices, and our bodies basically fall apart. Scurvy is a dystopian novel written by the human body. So, how can dogs live on meat and rice, neither of which has any vitamin C whatsoever, and not develop scurvy? They make their own. In fact, nearly all animals on the planet make plenty of their own vitamin C, usually in their livers, and thus have no need for it in their diets. Humans and other primates are nearly alone in the need for dietary vitamin C, although guinea pigs and fruit bats have this problem as well. This is because somewhere in our evolutionary past, human livers actually lost the ability to make this micronutrient. How did we lose the ability to make vitamin C? Well, it turns out that we do have all of the genes that are necessary for vitamin C synthesis, but one of them is broken, mutated to the point of being non-functional. The broken gene, known as GULO, codes for an enzyme that is responsible for a key step in the manufacture of vitamin C. Somewhere in the ancestors of primates, the GULO gene suffered a mutation, rendering it inoperable, and then random mutation continued, littering the gene with tiny errors. As if to mock the uselessness of pieces of DNA like this, scientists call them pseudogenes. We can still easily recognize the GULO gene in the human genome. It's there, and the vast majority of the code is the same as in other animals. But there are a few key parts that have been mutated. It's as if you removed the spark plug from a car. It's still a car. You can easily see that it is still a car. In fact, you would have to look very carefully to find anything wrong with it at all. But it cannot function as a car, not even slightly. It's totally inoperable, even though most of it is still exactly the way it was before it was broken. That's what happened to the GULO gene, way back in prehistory. The spark plug was removed by a random mutation. Over the course of evolutionary time, random mutations like this occur constantly. Often they are of no consequence, but sometimes they strike right in a gene. When that happens, it is almost always bad, because the mutation usually disrupts the functioning of the gene. In such cases, the individuals in whose genomes these mutations occurred are a little worse off, or a lot worse off, if the change brings on a deadly genetic condition like sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis. Often the deadliest of these mutations are eliminated from the population when the people who carry them die. This begs the question, why wasn't the GULO gene mutation eliminated? Scurvy is fatal. The consequences of this mutation ought to have been quick and harsh, and should have prevented the harmful error from spreading throughout the species. Well, maybe not. What if this disrupting mutation happened in a primate who, purely by chance, already had lots of vitamin C in her diet? For her, there would be no consequence of losing the ability to make vitamin C, since she already ate foods that contained it. What foods contain a lot of vitamin C? Citrus fruits. And where do citrus fruits mostly grow? Tropical rainforests. And where do most primates live? Bingo! The reason that the ancestors of primates could tolerate a mutation in the GULO gene was that, with plenty of vitamin C in their diets, anyway, scurvy wasn't an issue. Since that time, primates, with the exception of humans, have pretty much stuck to rainforest climates. This preferred habitat is both a cause and a consequence of their inability to make vitamin C. After all, while it's easy to break a gene by mutation, it's much more difficult to fix it. It's like slamming the computer when it's not working right. Sure, you might fix it, but more likely, you'll harm it. Primates aren't totally unique for having a screwed-up GULO gene. A few other animals have one as well. Not surprisingly, the ones that tolerate having the broken gene are the ones that get plenty of vitamin C in their diets. Take fruit bats, for example. They eat, fruit. Interestingly, our bodies, like those of other animals that have lost the ability to make vitamin C, have attempted to compensate by increasing dietary absorption of it. Animals that make their own vitamin C are typically very poor at absorbing it from their food because they just don't need it. Humans, however, absorb dietary vitamin C at a much higher rate. But even though we have learned to eat food with ample vitamin C, and even though our bodies are better at extracting these micronutrients from food, we have not managed to fully compensate for this malfunction. It's still a very poor design. In the days before fresh food from faraway places was readily available to people, scurvy was a common and often deadly disease. Other essential vitamins can give us just as much trouble as vitamin C. Take vitamin D. The commonly ingested form of vitamin D is not fully active, which means that we can't use it until it's processed in the liver and kidney. The precursor of the vitamin is also generated in the skin, providing the individual gets enough sunlight, but it still needs to be processed into the active form. Without enough dietary vitamin D, or enough sunlight, young humans can develop a disease called rickets, and older humans can develop osteoporosis. Rickets is extremely painful and leads to weak bones that break easily and heal slowly and, in severe cases, to stunted growth and skeletal deformities. Both of these conditions involve brittle and deformed bones, which can be extremely painful. Humans need calcium to keep bones strong, and we need vitamin D to help absorb calcium from food. We could eat all the calcium in the world, and none of it would be absorbed without sufficient vitamin D. This is why vitamin D is commonly added to milk. It helps our bodies absorb the calcium that the milk contains. Rickets is a uniquely human disease for a variety of reasons. First of all, we're the only species that wears clothing and usually lives indoors. Both of these factors reduce the amount of sunlight exposure of the skin, thus crippling the ability to make the precursor of vitamin D. It could be argued that this is not a problem of poor design, per se, but it's certainly not good design. The complex multi-step activation path for vitamin D is obnoxious enough, but requiring sunlight exposure to produce the precursor molecule adds another wrinkle, no pun intended, and is another way in which we can develop vitamin insufficiencies. Second, due to modern lifestyles and diets, we don't always consume enough vitamin D. While it is always tempting to blame modern eating habits for dietary insufficiencies, that's probably not true in this case. The innovations brought by civilization have reduced the incidence of rickets. To understand why, consider that in order to get sufficient vitamin D in our diets, we need to eat at least some fish, meat, or eggs. Pre-civilization humans consumed few, if any, eggs. While meat and fish were staples, they were almost certainly not available on a steady basis. Prehistoric life was marked by periods of feast and famine, and we know from studying the bones of early humans that rickets and brittle bones were a constant problem. Not so for us modern humans in the developed world with our abundant sources of animal protein. The domestication of animals for meat and eggs, roughly 5,000 years ago in the Middle East, and at different points elsewhere, mostly solved the problem of rickets. This is just one example of human ingenuity overcoming the design limitations of the human body, a theme we will encounter again and again in this book. What about the many other vitamins listed on that bottle of multivitamins? Many of them fall into the family of B vitamins. There are 8 different B vitamins, which often go by other names, such as niacin, biotin, riboflavin, and folic acid, or folate. Each of these vitamins is required for various chemical reactions throughout the body, and each has its own syndrome associated with insufficiency. Among the most well-known B vitamin deficiency syndromes results from not having enough vitamin B12, also called cobalamin. This vitamin is familiar to long-term vegans because B12 deficiency is a problem they invariably have to face. It leads to anemia. Humans cannot make their own vitamin B12. And since plants have no need for this vitamin, they do not produce it. So the only dietary sources of it are in meat, dairy, seafood, arthropods, other animal-derived foods, and vitamin supplements. Vegans, take note. You need these pills. But what about vegetarian animals? There are many animals that eat only plants. But if plants don't have any B12, and all animals need B12 to survive, how do cows, sheep, horses, and the thousands of other herbivorous animals avoid anemia? The answer is that they make it. Or rather, the bacteria in their large intestines make B12 for them. You probably already know that the large intestines of mammals are chock full of bacteria. Because bacteria are so much smaller than animal cells, there are more individual bacterial cells in your colon than there are human cells in your entire body. That's right. The bacteria that live in your body outnumber your own cells. They also do some important things for you. Vitamin K, for example, is made by the bacteria in the gut, and we simply absorb it from there. You don't need supplements or foods that contain it as long as you have the bacteria that produce it in your gut. Just like vitamin K, vitamin B12 is made by our intestinal bacteria. Yet we need to get more vitamin B12 in our diets. Why is that? Here is the design flaw. Bacteria make B12 in the large intestine, the colon, but we can't absorb it from there. We absorb B12 in the small intestine, which comes before the large intestine in the flow of traffic within the digestive system. So the wonderful bacteria of the human gut are nice enough to provide B12 for us, but the gut is so poorly designed that we send all of that B12 to the toilet. And yes, in case you are wondering, you could eat your feces to get the B12 you need, but I hope you will never be that desperate. The bad plumbing job of our intestines has rendered B12 an essential dietary vitamin for humans, while all the millions of herbivore animals are blissfully unbothered by any need to find and eat this molecule. The next most famous B vitamin deficiency syndrome is beriberi, caused by a lack of vitamin B1, also known as thiamine. Thiamine is required for a variety of chemical reactions in the body, the most important of which is converting carbohydrates and fats into usable energy. As a result of thiamine insufficiency, people can suffer nerve damage, muscle weakness, and heart failure. Incredibly, despite this vitamin's importance, we cannot make it ourselves. Like B12, vitamin B1 must come from our diets. Also, like B12, B1 can't be made by any animal. Only bacteria, most plants, and some fungi can make it. So, at least we share this flaw with all our fellow animals. Except animals never get beriberi, and humans have suffered massively from it. In fact, during the 16th and 17th centuries, it is estimated that beriberi was second only to smallpox in causing human death. Why only us? The reason that other animals don't suffer from beriberi is that B1 is abundant in a wide variety of plant foods, found at the base of most food chains. In the oceans, many of the photosynthetic bacteria and protists found in plankton make B1, and it proceeds up the food chain from there. Filter-feeding plankton eaters like the massive blue whale get it directly, but carnivorous fish and mammals often eat things that eat plankton. In any case, B1 makes the rounds. Same thing on land. Many land plants are rich in B1, meeting the dietary needs of herbivores, which are then eaten by carnivores, which are then eaten by apex predators, among which are humans, although we also eat plants, of course. So why do humans struggle with beriberi when no other animals do? The answer seems to lie in how we prepare our food. As humans invented and refined agriculture, They began to process foods in various ways to make them taste better and last longer without spoiling or becoming unpalatable. Often these methods stripped many nutrients out of food. For reasons that are not always understood, nutrients are not spread evenly throughout a plant. For example, the skins of potatoes and apples are where most of their vitamins A and C are located, so peeling them can rob them of most of their nutrients. This can be seen acutely in the removal of rice husks. Unrefined rice, or brown rice, is rich in B1. Refining raw rice, also called polishing, allows the rice to be dried and stored safely for years. And this agricultural innovation made a huge difference in preventing famine, especially in Asian populations, where rice is a staple. However, rice polishing removes essentially all the vitamin B1. This was not a problem for the wealthy elite in Asian cultures, since the B1-rich meat and vegetables that they ate supplemented the B1-poor rice. However, for the vast majority of Asian people, beriberi was an endemic condition for thousands of years. It is still a concern in poor remote villages. The scourge of beriberi may not technically be an example of poor human design, since it has plagued us only since the dawn of civilization and is due to our own innovations. However, it is an example of how our evolutionary limitations can be exacerbated or ameliorated as we continue to develop as a species. Were it not for human innovations in agriculture and horticulture, civilization would not be possible in the first place. The same technology that led to high rates of beriberi allowed our species to advance past the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. Civilization enabled humans to lead healthier lives in a variety of ways, as evidenced by the explosion of the human population. Beriberi was a trade-off our ancestors made unknowingly, because they didn't realize that their bodies could not produce a simple molecule required for the most basic chemical function, converting dietary calories into usable energy. So you could say that one cost of technology and civilization is beriberi. To be sure, making our own vitamins is complicated and labor-intensive. Vitamins are complex organic molecules, many of them bearing a striking and distinct structure not closely related to other molecules. To produce them, the body must have an elaborate pathway of enzyme-catalyzed chemical reactions. Each of those enzymes must be encoded by a gene. Those genes must be maintained, copied faithfully each time a cell divides, translated into proteins, and then regulated to match supply with demand. In the grand scheme of metabolism, the number of calories that an organism spends on synthesizing necessary vitamins is small, but it is not zero. Given all of that, it is somewhat understandable why some organisms have foregone the making of their own vitamins and opted to obtain them from their diets instead. There is a certain logic to that. After all, why go to all of the trouble of making vitamin C when you already have it in your diet? Yet, just because we don't always need to make some essential vitamins doesn't mean it's a good idea to relinquish the ability to make them. Doing so would be terribly short-sighted, since humans would be stuck with that dietary requirement forever. Once a gene is broken, it is hard to unbreak it. That logic does not apply to the essential amino acids, whose simple structures are very easy for cells to fashion. And yet we still can't make many of them, either. Acid tests. Amino acids are about as different from vitamins as two types of organic molecules can be. All organisms use 20 different kinds of amino acids to build proteins. Humans have tens of thousands of different proteins in their bodies, all of which are made with the same 20 building blocks. All 20 amino acids are structurally similar, each being a slight variation of another. To build these 20 amino acids, therefore, we don't need 20 separate pathways. Sometimes only a single chemical reaction is needed to change one amino acid into another. This is a far cry from the contortions the human body must go through to create different types of vitamins, and the uses for amino acids are much more varied than those for vitamins. Nevertheless, we cannot make some of the amino acids for ourselves and must get them from our diets. In fact, 9 of the 20 amino acids are called essential because we have lost the ability to manufacture them. I said that we have lost that ability because as we look back through evolutionary time, we find ancestors who could make some or all of them. A wide swath of unrelated microorganism species, bacteria, archaea, fungi, and protists, can synthesize all 20 amino acids, as well as the components needed for DNA, lipids, and complex carbohydrates. These extremely self-sufficient organisms can get by on just a simple carbon-based energy source, such as glucose, and a little organic nitrogen in the form of ammonia. It's not just microorganisms that can make all their own amino acids either. Most plant species are capable of synthesizing all 20 amino acids. As a matter of fact, plants are even more self-reliant than most microorganisms because they can synthesize the energy source themselves too, using energy from the sun. Given a simple, balanced soil that contains organic nitrogen, many plants can live without any form of supplementation whatsoever. Plants don't eat anything. They make all of their own food internally. This remarkable self-sufficiency means that plants don't really require any other organisms, at least not for short-term day-to-day needs. This helps to explain how plants thrived on the dry land for 100 million years, growing into impenetrably thick forests before animals emerged from the oceans and began eating them. Animals are the exact opposite of self-sufficient. They must constantly eat other living things in order to survive. They can eat plants, algae, or plankton, or they can eat other animals that eat them. Either way, animals must get all of their energy from organic molecules made by other living things, since they cannot harvest solar energy themselves. Since humans have to eat other living things anyway, we've gotten a bit lazy. While we eat plants and other animals mainly for their energy, consuming them also brings us all the proteins, fats, sugars, and even vitamins and minerals that those living things have in their bodies. We're not getting just energy when we eat. In other words, we're also getting various organic building blocks. This frees us from having to constantly make those molecules ourselves. If you are provided with a nice serving of the amino acid lysine, for example, every time you eat, why should you bother to spend energy making it? Of course, each plant and animal has different amounts and combinations of amino acids. If we stop making lysine ourselves, we might be okay on a diet of fish and crabs, which are high in lysine, but a diet of berries and insects, low lysine foods, would hurt us. That's the problem with discarding the ability to make certain nutrients. In order to save a few calories of energy, we lock ourselves into certain diets or lifestyles that we cannot change on pain of death. This is a dangerous game because the world is in a continuous state of flux. Every single geographic location and microenvironment has seen its share of upheavals, fluctuations, and catastrophes. The only constant in life is change. Yet, evolution has made these short-sighted trade-offs in humans again and again. Our species has lost the ability to make 9 of the 20 amino acids. Each loss is the result of at least one mutational event, usually more. Mutations happen to individuals randomly, of course. They become fixed in the population, either by pure chance or because they offer some sort of distinct advantage. In the case of the mutations that destroyed our ability to make amino acids, it was probably a matter of chance. When humans lost the ability to synthesize several amino acids, they gained nothing but the risk of debilitating, even deadly, dietary deficiencies. So how were these mutations not quickly eliminated when they occurred? Because our species' diets compensated for this loss, just like we saw with vitamin C. A diet with at least occasional meat or dairy consumption usually provides enough of each essential amino acid. Plant-based diets, however, need to be planned more carefully, because different kinds of plants provide different ratios of the 20 amino acids. As a result, variety is the easiest way for vegetarians and vegans to ensure that they get enough of all the amino acids they need. In the developed world, it is not difficult for a vegan to acquire all the 9 essential amino acids. A single serving of rice and beans can give a whole day's supply, provided that the rice is unrefined and the beans are of the black, red, or kidney variety. Further, chickpeas, also called garbanzo beans, contain large quantities of all 9 essential amino acids all by themselves, as do quinoa and a few other so-called superfoods. However, among the poor, especially in developing countries, a varied diet is not always an option. There are billions of humans who subsist on extremely simple diets, consisting of just a few staples, and those staples often do not provide enough of some of the essential amino acids, especially lysine. In some remote Chinese villages, the poorest of the poor will live on nothing but rice and the occasional scrap of meat, egg, or bean curd. In the poorest parts of Africa, the most destitute subsist on diets composed almost entirely of wheat products, and even those become scarce during famines. Unsurprisingly, given examples like these, protein deficiency is the single most life-threatening dietary problem in the developing world. This problem stems directly from our species' inability to make certain amino acids. The problem of amino acid deficiency is not unique to the modern world by any means. Pre-industrial humanity probably dealt with protein and amino acid insufficiency on a regular basis. Sure, large hunted animals such as mammoths provided protein and amino acids aplenty. However, living off big game in the era before refrigeration meant humans had to endure alternating periods of feast and famine. Droughts, forest fires, superstorms, and ice ages led to long stretches of difficult conditions, and starvation was a constant threat. The human inability to synthesize such basic things as amino acids certainly exacerbated those crises and made surviving on whatever was available that much harder. During a famine, it's not the lack of calories that is the ultimate cause of death. It's the lack of proteins and the essential amino acids they provide. Amino acids are not the only basic biomolecules that humans and other animals have lost the ability to synthesize. 2 other examples come from a group of molecules called fatty acids. These long hydrocarbons are the building blocks for fats and other lipids that the body needs, such as phospholipids, which help form the membranes that surround every single cell. It is hard to think of a more essential structure than the cell membrane. Yet, one of the 2 fatty acids that we cannot produce, both of which have tongue-twister names, is linoleic acid, which forms part of the cell membrane. The other one, alpha-linoleic acid, is used to help regulate inflammation, another hugely important internal process. Luckily for us, modern human diets have provided these 2 essential fatty acids in sufficient quantities in the form of seeds, fish, and various vegetable oils. Fortunately, too, several studies have shown that frequent consumption of these fatty acids leads to improved cardiovascular health. But we weren't always so lucky. In prehistory, especially in the era before agriculture, human diets tended to be much simpler. Roving bands ate what they could find, doing their best to follow the food. Most of the time, these fatty acids were probably available, but there can be little doubt that periods of deficiencies existed as well. Sometimes grass, bugs, leaves, and the occasional berry were all that could be found. Just as with essential amino acids that we cannot synthesize ourselves, losing the supply of 2 important fatty acids would make any food crisis that much worse. What is most maddening about these 2 fatty acids is that they can be made pretty easily. Our cells can synthesize a whole host of lipid molecules. many of them quite a bit more complex than linoleic acid and alpha-linoleic acid. In fact, we make many very elaborate lipids from these simple ones, yet we cannot make these two themselves. The enzymes necessary to produce these particular fatty acids exist in many organisms on Earth, but humans aren't one of them. The human body, like the bodies of all animals, takes in plant or animal tissue, mashes it up, absorbs the small constituents, and uses the little bits to build its own molecules, cells, and tissues. However, there are gaps in this scheme. There are several molecules that are crucial for human health that we are incapable of making, so we have no choice but to seek them out in our food. The fact that we need to find these essential nutrients places restrictions on where and how humans can live. And that's just organic nutrients. The human body is also terrible at obtaining the inorganic kind, known as minerals, even when they are right there in what we eat. Heavy metal machines. For squishy, water-based creatures, we humans sure do need a lot of metal in our diets. There are all kinds of metals, known as essential minerals, that we have to eat. Metal ions are single atoms, not complex molecules, and they cannot be synthesized by any living thing. They must be ingested in food or water, and the list of ions that are essential for us includes cobalt, copper, iron, chromium, nickel, zinc, and molybdenum. Even magnesium, potassium, calcium, and sodium are technically metals, and we need substantial amounts of these minerals daily, too. We don't think of these minerals as metallic because we don't consume or use them in their elemental forms. Instead, cells use metals in their water-soluble, ionized forms. To appreciate the stark difference, consider sodium. Sodium, as it appears on the periodic table in its elemental form, is a metal so reactive that it catches fire if it comes in contact with water. It's highly toxic. A tiny amount could kill a large animal. However, when we remove a single electron from a sodium atom, turning it into an ion, it has completely different properties. Ionized sodium is more than simply harmless. It is essential for all living cells. It combines with chloride ions to form table salt. For all intents and purposes, elemental sodium is a completely different substance than ionized sodium. While sodium and potassium are inarguably among the most important of the metal ions, in the sense that no cells can function without them, humans almost never have a chronic lack of these minerals in their diets. All living things have these two ions in relative abundance. So, whether you're paleo, vegan, or something in between, you will get the sodium and potassium that you need. Acute deficiencies of sodium or potassium can be an urgent problem, but they are usually the result of physiological dysfunction, fasting, excessive dehydration, or some other short-term insult. For other essential ions, the story is different. If you aren't eating them, you aren't getting enough of them, and you'll suffer chronic illness as a result. Inadequate calcium intake, for example, is a problem throughout the world, affecting both rich and poor. Calcium insufficiency is one of the most frustrating dietary problems from a design standpoint because lack of calcium stems from our species' poor ability to absorb it, rather than from not having enough of it in our food. We all eat plenty of calcium. We just aren't very good at extracting it from food. As already mentioned, vitamin D is required for calcium absorption. So if you're deficient in vitamin D, all the dietary calcium in the world cannot help you because it will proceed right through your gut undisturbed. Even if we have plenty of vitamin D, we still aren't very good at absorbing calcium, and we get worse and worse at it as we age. While infants can absorb a respectable 60% of the calcium they consume, adults can hope to absorb only around 20%, and by retirement age, that drops to 10% or even lower. Our intestines are so bad at extracting calcium from food that our bodies are forced to extract it from our bones instead, a strategy with devastating consequences. Without constant calcium and vitamin D supplementation, most people would develop the brittle bones of osteoporosis in their golden years. In prehistoric times, few humans lived beyond 30 or 40, so you might think that calcium deficiency was not such a problem for our ancestors. Yet, even so, the majority of ancient skeletal remains show the telltale signs of calcium and vitamin D deficiency, and they appear more drastically and in younger people than we typically see today. So osteoporosis and the calcium shortages that can create it are definitely not new problems. Neither is the difficulty humans often encounter with getting enough of another vital mineral, iron. Iron is the most abundant transition metal, the class of metals occupying the huge center section of the periodic table, and known for conducting electricity well, in our bodies and in the earth. As with the other metals, we make use of ionized iron atoms, not the elemental metal form. Most of that elemental stuff sank to the core of the earth shortly after it formed. What we have here on the surface is mostly the ions lacking one, two, or three electrons. In fact, the ease with which iron can switch among these different ionized states is the secret behind its special utility in our cells. The most commonly known role of iron is in the functioning of hemoglobin, the protein that transports oxygen throughout our bodies. Red blood cells are absolutely packed with this protein, each molecule of which needs four iron atoms. In fact, the iron atoms in hemoglobin are what give it its characteristic red color, which means your blood and the surface of Mars have more in common than you might think. Iron is also vital for other crucial functions, including the harvesting of energy from food. Despite the fact that there is plenty of iron in our bodies, our environment, our Earth, and our solar system, deficiencies in iron are among the most common diet-related ailments in humans. In fact, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, known as the CDC, and the World Health Organization, WHO, iron deficiency is the single most common nutritional deficiency in the United States and worldwide. That iron deficiency is pandemic in a world filled with iron is paradoxical, to say the least. The most acute problem caused by iron insufficiency is anemia, a word that loosely translates to not enough blood. Because iron is central to the hemoglobin molecule, and hemoglobin is central to red blood cell structure and function, low iron levels impair the body's ability to make blood cells. The WHO estimates that 50% of pregnant women and 40% of preschool children are anemic due to iron deficiency. Current estimates are that 2 billion of the world's 7 billion people are at least mildly anemic. Millions die from the deficiency each year. Once again, poor design is mostly to blame for the body's problems. To start with, the human gastrointestinal tract is terrible at extracting iron from plant sources. Plant and animal-derived iron are structurally different things. In animals, iron is generally found in blood and muscle tissue, and it's easy enough to process. Humans usually have little trouble extracting iron from a nice hunk of steak. The iron in plants, however, is embedded in protein complexes that are much harder for the human gut to rip apart, and so they remain in the gastrointestinal tract and end up as waste, making iron consumption another concern for vegetarians. In this respect, humans are worse off than most animals. The majority of the creatures on Earth are mostly or completely vegetarian, yet their intestines do just fine in processing iron. Additionally, there are many quirks about iron consumption that can further reduce absorption of it. For instance, we absorb iron best when it comes together with something else we readily absorb. For example, vitamin C. Vegetarians use this trick to boost their iron absorption. By combining sources of iron with sources of vitamin C, they can ensure that their bodies are better able to absorb both. A large dose of vitamin C can increase iron absorption sixfold. Unfortunately, the opposite is also true. A diet poor in vitamin C makes iron absorption more difficult, often leading to the double whammy of scurvy and anemia. Just imagine that combination. It's bad enough that you are pale and lethargic, but you could also lose muscle tone and begin bleeding internally. Vegetarian